I was going through my audio archive for a project I'm working on and realized something that sparked this idea I'm about to share with you. We're going to go back to some previous interviews from here on Issues and Ideas. Now, while the topics discussed may be dated, still worthy of the knowledge that they contain, but nevertheless, I want you to listen closely, real closely, to the person I'm speaking with. And there's a reason I'm asking you to do this, which I'll explain to you in a bit. So, let's start with this conversation I had with Peter Navarro.
In recent times, China has grown to be looked at as a driving economic force in the world economy. That force has been subjected to fluctuations as the growth rate of the Chinese economy has slowed. Another element of world impact for China is the subject of my next guest's new book. He presents an examination of China's military structure, exploration, and direction to determine its potential paths, influence, impact, and whether America and the rest of the world either keeping up or maintaining a lead against it and the threat it could possibly pose. His book is Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. He's a professor at UC Irvine who's lived and worked in China. Say good morning to Professor Peter Navarro. Good morning, Professor.
How are you, my friend? What's going on today?
Well, it's talking about a topic where people might be repelled against because of the depths by which others do it, but you do it in a rather human way that I think brings people. Let me give you a couple of websites listening first. CrouchingTiger.net for Peter's book, and the rest of Peter's work is PeterNavarro.com. And what was your mission with Crouching Tiger? What did you set out to do with the presentation of what you did?
It's really a twofold mission. One is basically we've got a presidential election going on, and we've neglected the most important area of the world, Asia. 50% of the population, 70% of the future economic growth. And this country, in terms of its foreign policy, has been distracted and bogged down in other parts of the world, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. And as that has happened, China has risen dramatically, both as an economic and military power. And it's now really threatening the interests of the United States. So I wanted to bring that issue to one of the top issues of the 2016 presidential campaign. So for your listeners, I mean, if you get a chance to talk to the candidates or go to a debate, raise it. So that's one of the issues. The other is, you know, these are complex topics and hard times in an era when people are tired of thinking about conflict and war, and who can blame them. But I wanted to make this issue accessible to anyone who reads the daily newspaper. And so I've constructed the whole question of will there be war with China as a what I call a geopolitical detective story. And there's a bunch of chapters in the book. Each one starts with a question and clue. And we work through the evidence. And your conclusions as you solve that mystery may not necessarily be the same as mine or anybody else's, because the evidence is the evidence, and you can make your own conclusions. But that was my mission, basically, to get people thinking about this, particularly as we go to the store and pick up all this Made in China stuff, because literally what we're doing when we're doing that now is giving China the money to build weapons that they now aim against us.
Yeah, it seems odd, too, or maybe even disappointing with the number of presidential candidates, especially on the Republican side. It seems like the only one who's been talking about China has been Trump.
That's exactly right. And Trump, interestingly enough, is quite well-read in this issue. I mean, given the nature of this show, you might find it interesting. Back in 2011, he was asked what his favorite China books were, and the reporter was basically trying to get him in a Sarah Palin moment where, oh, I don't know. And he proceeded to reel off 20 books in the order of his preference on China. And one of them was my earlier work, Death by China, so that's how it came on my radar. But, I mean, I can't even do that. That was impressive. So he's there. I mean, Marco Rubio is good on this issue in the sense of he's doing his homework. But beyond that, on the Republican side, not a whole lot of depth. And, of course, on the Democratic side, you've got Hillary Clinton, who was in office as the Secretary of State when she announced the so-called pivot to Asia, which I cover in the book Crouching Tiger. And check this out. This is really kind of interesting. What we said was, the Obama administration said was, We need to go to Asia for all the reasons I articulated earlier, because of economic and strategic reasons. So what we're going to do is, instead of having 60% of our ships in the rest of the world and 40% in Asia, we're going to flip that. We're going to pivot, rebalance to Asia. But here's the problem. Our Navy has steadily shrunk from 600 ships in the Reagan era down to about close to 200 now, and it's fallen precipitously during the Obama administration. And given the trend, what's going to happen, and here is the punchline, by the year 2020, we are going to put 60% of our ships in Asia, but because we have less ships, there's going to be less ships there when we started the pivot. So we're basically talking loudly but carrying a very small ship there.
Just a reminder, you're listening to a conversation from a previous Issues and Ideas. Reason why I'm doing this, I'll have an explanation for you very shortly.
When you look at the foundation of what could be the catalyst for China's actions, and you look back in history, one of the surprises, I think, one of the early surprises that people get when they read Crouching Tiger is we see China as a dominant force, but throughout history, they've been a target of invasion and limitations, not always by their own doing either.
Yes, I think it's, to be fair to China, I think it's really important to understand their psyche and mindset and why they would think to build up a military. And there's really two reasons that are good intentions. One is to protect their homeland. Then they did go through what's called the century of humiliation, which spanned from 1839 to 1945. It began with British gunships coming in and basically seizing all of the ports of China up and down their coast. And then included the Russians taking what is today the port of Vladivostok. It included German and French and American troops in the Forbidden City. And the Japanese, of course, just the havoc they wreaked. So the Chinese have a legitimate reason to build up a military. And also, because they're a trading nation now, with most of their growth dependent on exports, there's no question they need a powerful navy to protect their trading routes. The problem, which I describe in the Crouching Tiger book, however, is that in addition to these good intentions to protect their homeland, they also have these bad intentions. I mean, we have Chinese warships and U.S. warships circling right now over territory in the South China Sea, and that's an example of China's bad intentions. China claims, think about this now, they claim 80% of the South China Sea, which is one of the largest bodies in the world through which one-third of all global shipping transits. We as a nation cannot allow them to control a body of water like that, because it would basically choke off trade and growth, not just for us, but for all the other countries in Asia.
It would be like having Iran have oversight over the Straits of Hormuz, where the
Correct.
Shipping lane for oil is in and out.
Or even the whole Persian Gulf, or in this country, it would be like Mexico claiming the Gulf of Mexico. And the reason why China does it, there's this thing, it was a term, revanchism, which basically means a country pursues claims for territory based on historical issues. And modern international law does not recognize that. And the biggest revanchist on the block today, besides China, is Russia. Russia and its revanchist adventures, of course, taking the Crimea, going into Ukraine and eastern Ukraine, trying to reclaim the Baltic states. That's revanchism and expansionism. And one other thing that truly is frightening, and it's a great question for the presidential candidates, is, you know, what about this rising China-Russia axis? You marry China, the largest population in the world with the biggest factory floor, with Russia, which is the largest country by landmass and has the most diverse and deepest set of natural resources in the world. You put those two together, and on top of that, the Russians actually have the best air and missile defense systems in the world. You put those two together and let them run rampant in Europe and Asia, and that's a recipe for a world that is very unstable, that's going to be difficult to live in. And that's why this election is so important. That's why putting somebody in the White House who understands these issues is going to be critical.
Oh, Professor Peter Navarro, Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World, crouchingtiger.net, peternavarro.com, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. Got about a minute and change left here. Does China want a battle against the U.S.? Are they doing it just to detour what they imagine or foresee as aggression by the U.S., or does China want to do almost what Reagan did to Russia, build up a force, cause Russia to go well past their economic means, and China seeing our economy still in the tank, thinking they could do the same to us?
You know, that's a beautiful question, and I think there's two ways they think they can beat us. One is to do what the U.S. did, not just to the Soviet Union, but also to Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, and Kaiser Germany in World War One, which is to use, we used our superior manufacturing might to overwhelm those adversaries, right? China thinks it can do that today because they're the factory floor and our economy's in decline. So that's number one. But the other historical note here, I think, which is interesting, is to go back five centuries to Sun Tzu, the acme of skill is to win without fighting. What they really want to do is not to sink an American aircraft carrier per se, but to make whoever sits in the White House think that they can do it. And once we think they can do it, then we hesitate. We hem and haw. If China makes a move on Taiwan, we're paralyzed by indecision. And then China takes what it wants without fighting. And that's a world, again, that we don't want to live in as Americans, not because necessarily we have to defend Taiwan for democracy, but because our interests, our economic and strategic interests, are in Asia. I mean, we just go back to Imperial Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, and you understand what happens when an Asian superpower rises.
CrouchingTiger.net is the website for the book. There's accompanying video programs, too, that go along with Peter's work. And for the rest of Peter's work, PeterNavarro.com. Crouching Tiger, what China's militarism means for the world. Peter Navarro, you do issue a wake-up call, and I hope the alarm is loud enough for all who need to hear it. Thanks for doing that, for being here this morning.
And thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Now let's go back to this talk I had with Jenna Ellis.
Almost immediately after President Trump announced his nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court, voices objecting to the nomination quickly sought to be heard. Some, although hard-pressed for actual facts, objected on legal standards, while most objected to the nomination for political reasons. While politics can cause the direction a nomination takes, nominee is who they are, and here with offer an analysis of Judge Neil Gorsuch from Colorado Christian University is Professor Dr. Jenna Ellis. Thanks for being here today, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
And learn more about Colorado Christian University. Their website is ccu.edu. And I guess for any individual standing before the public on a platform, there's a substance and personality profiles. As far as substance when it comes to Judge Gorsuch, what does his track record demonstrate?
He is an excellent choice, and I think it's important for both sides when analyzing this particular nominee to realize that Judge Gorsuch is coming from a perspective of an originalist and a textualist. And what that means in terms of constitutional law interpretation is that he's going to be looking at the Constitution and the law as written and apply that to the case rather than promoting a specific agenda. And so when conservatives are very happy about this, we're conserving something, right? That's why we're called conservatives. And what we're conserving is the original intent of the Constitution, preserving and protecting the unalienable rights of every individual. And so Judge Gorsuch should be applauded, and both sides should be excited about this particular nomination because he specifically doesn't come from just one agenda or the other. And so both sides should actually be happy about this nomination.
Which also would respond to Senator Schumer's plea that the nominee be mainstream. How much more mainstream can you be than adhering fully, strictly, and loyally to the U.S. Constitution?
Exactly. And that just shows that he doesn't have an accurate definition of mainstream. And if by mainstream Chuck Schumer is referring to some of the social issues and some of the things that the progressives over the last 50 and 60 years have read into the Constitution, then of course Judge Gorsuch is not going to be mainstream within that definition. He's going to look at the Constitution, apply it as written, and that's exactly what we should expect from a Supreme Court justice.
Unless you're one of those individuals who defines the Constitution as a, quote, living, breathing document, then originalist is certainly going to be your enemy.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny now that President Trump is in office how the progressives have started actually quoting the Constitution. They've rediscovered the free exercise clause. They've rediscovered some of these things in the Constitution that they're now trying to apply, where just last year they were claiming that this is an outdated, ancient document that has no relevance for today. And so we can see that their definition of mainstream and their definition even of the Constitution itself is flexible depending on what they want at the moment. And Judge Gorsuch has very firm principles. He has a track record of over 10 years of interpreting the Constitution and the law based on those legal principles and the rule of law. And this is a great, great nomination.
I believe he also clerked for one of the justices.
He did, actually, two of them. So he had also clerked for Justice Kennedy, who's still on the bench. He also clerked for Justice White previously. And I think that that also may be a really great point for the conservatives, because Justice Kennedy, of course, although he was originally a conservative nomination, he's been that swing vote in some of the more social agenda and progressive cases. And with a pre-established relationship as a law clerk for Justice Kennedy, hopefully Judge Gorsuch, when he's confirmed, would be able to have some influence on Justice Kennedy and hopefully bring him back to interpreting the rule of law and the Constitution as it's written.
Just want to remind you, this is a conversation from a past edition of Issues and Ideas. Reason I'm doing this, I'll have the answer for you coming up real soon.
Considering that Judge Gorsuch is 49 years old, this would be one of those heritage nominations as far as the Trump administration is concerned, as far as the court's concerned, because should he be, and most people do believe he will be confirmed, this could be a significant long-term impact on the court.
It will, and that was during the campaign last year. That was actually one of the forefront issues, was the Supreme Court, because this particular confirmation, especially because he is so young, and if there are more openings, possibly two or three additional openings, just given the aging out of some of the other members of the bench, then the Trump administration could certainly impact the court for the next 30 or 40 years. And for me in particular, being a constitutional law attorney, that was one of the primary and probably the key voting issue for me during the campaign.
People who aren't the most knowledgeable when it comes to history will argue with the constitutionalists and say, well, how do you know what the founders meant? Completely ignorant of the fact that Madison and many others kept extensive diaries during those times in Philadelphia back in 1787. So you could read the Constitution, read the notes, you could see what won and lost in that debate during those months. And likewise, today you can learn a lot by what someone writes. And these are a couple of quotes I found by Judge Gorsuch. And one case he wrote, judges should strive, if humanely and so imperfectly, to apply the law as it is, focusing backward, not forward, and looking to text, structure, and history to decide what a reasonable reader at the time of the events in question would have understood the law to be, not to decide cases based on their own moral convictions or the policy consequences they believe might serve society best. In other words, doesn't sound like Judge Gorsuch would be an activist judge like we've seen so often here on the New Jersey Supreme Court, for example.
Right, and that's an excellent quote from Judge Gorsuch, and this whole idea that a judge shouldn't implement policy based on his own political consideration or even his own personal perspective. And if we look to the Constitution in context, and we see that it's five pages long, it's really not that difficult for an attorney to look at that and determine what it means. In context, it is only a grant of limited, specific powers to the federal government in order to preserve and protect the individual's rights. Our rights don't come from government, and the Declaration of Independence acknowledged that. It said that we understand that truth is. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And then it goes on to say that the only proper role of the civil government is to preserve and protect those rights. And so if we understand the Constitution in context with the Declaration, it's simply fulfilling that mandate, that here are very specific, limited powers to the federal government to operate to preserve and protect those rights that are clearly defined already, because they come from God, and that's why we are a Judeo-Christian society. not a theocracy, not that the church controls the civil government, but rather that we understand all of truth and all of reality is imposed by God. And so to understand and acknowledge that, the founders set up this wonderful, wonderful system where the civil government is actually restrained, and it cannot dictate to us what our rights are and what they're not. And so we're seeing that the progressives have this completely backwards, and the liberals have this idea that our rights actually come from government. And so when a president or a judge gets on the bench, or there's a new trend in an administration, then they believe that their rights can change and are flexible depending on who's in office. Conservatives understand something much different, and what the founders understood, and we can see just from the text that they acknowledged. And Judge Gorsuch is looking at that particular text, and he understands and sees that the Constitution in context is just the specific limited powers granted to the federal government. And so if he goes by just those limited powers, then the powers not granted to the federal government are reserved through the 10th Amendment to the states. And I think that when he gets on the bench, he will acknowledge that, and he will revive the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment, which say that the states should be the ones to determine some of these other issues that are not textually within the Constitution and granted to the federal government. So it's really important that we understand the Constitution in that context as well.
And with that philosophy being fact about Judge Gorsuch, shouldn't that eliminate any concerns by any opponents of his nomination that he would be there as a mouthpiece for whatever the Trump agenda is going to be?
It should, absolutely. And if liberals are being reasonable, and we're certainly seeing over the last couple of weeks of rioting and marches and, you know, kind of these insane comments, they're not being reasonable. But if the senators, if the Democratic senators are being reasonable and they are looking at Judge Gorsuch's track record and understanding that he's exactly the sort of judge that the president promised and what the American people want and should want, which is to follow the law and not policy preference, then he's not being nominated because he's going to fulfill a specific agenda, either way, liberal or conservative. He is going to follow the law, and that should please and satisfy everyone, regardless of which side of the aisle they're on.
And not having seen Judge Gorsuch in action, but having read his philosophy, his beliefs, and his eye of the law, I think these are going to be some very interesting confirmation hearings coming up that will be historic in many ways, and will be, if you're a political junkie, certainly fun to watch too. Learn more about Colorado Christian University at ccu.edu. We've been joined by one of the professors, Dr. Jenna Ellis. Doctor, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Are you catching the clues here? This might be confusing to you, but just trust me.